Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here, The Tom Woods Show.
Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. Welcome back to The Tom Woods Show. I'm here with our old friend Tom DiLorenzo, who is the author of a zillion books and recently retired from Loyola University Baltimore. I beg your pardon. And he is now, though, as he's just telling me, he'd been sort of semi-retired for a while. And in fact, when you were in Delray Beach, we visited you during the worst of COVID. And yet in Delray Beach, you could still see live music, even then in 2020.
Yes.
But you have now, all of a sudden, a rather significant life change in the form of being selected to be the next president of the Mises Institute. So congratulations.
Thank you very much. I'm excited about it and hope to do some great things in the coming years.
I assume that means you move to Auburn.
Yeah, well, it's not tomorrow, but I'm working on it.
Okay.
In the new year, I'll probably be there more or less permanently. They're renovating an office for me, so I have to have a place to work.
Yeah.
And so, yeah.
So what was your, I can recall 1993 was the year I got involved with the Mises Institute as a student. I went to Mises University for the first time. But what was your entry point?
Oh, my entry point, I guess, well, I was an assistant professor at George Mason in the 80s, shortly after the Mises Institute was created, and I got a postcard announcing the creation of the Mises Institute. That must have been 1983. And so I sent them a check for $50, and they sent me back a Mises tie, and I wrote Mary Rothbard a letter saying, I'll wear it with pride in the halls of academia, and it'll have the same effect as flashing a Christian cross in front of Dracula. And I was told that Murray laughed his head off over that. And a few years later, I started participating in some of the conferences and things, early conferences, where there'd be maybe 25 people. And it was the same people every year at the very beginning, the old faithful followers and donors. And that was my beginning of the relationship. And then I started teaching at Mises University, probably, I don't know, around 1991, 92, around there, shortly before you showed up.
Yeah, that's right. And when I showed up, I was such a nerd because in the old days before the internet, the Institute would send you books, physical books in the mail, but they would also send you a list of recommended readings. But they were generally readings in academic journals that you would have access to only at a university library. So I dug those out and read those too. And I remember I dug out one of your academic articles, and I was such a kiss-up and a nerd that I think I might have even told you that I read your article on such and such. But was that your first interaction with Rothbard, that note, or had you met him before?
Yeah, I had met him, but as a graduate student, back when Virginia Tech was called Virginia Polytechnic Institute. It used to be known as VPI, and that's where I got my PhD degree in economics. But Richard Wagner, who's an Austrian, ran a lecture series my first year in graduate school. And since he was in charge, at the end of every school year, the economics department would have a big shot two-day seminar from some big shot. And Wagner chose Murray Rothbard to be the big shot of the year. And so it was the first time I very briefly met him. But I didn't really get to know him at all until later, after the Mises Institute was created.
Who was your advisor for your PhD?
Well, I sort of talked with James Buchanan a lot. My actual advisor was a man named Paul Downing. He's the one who did all the heavy lifting and making sure I got finished. But it was in the area of public finance, and so I was sort of a student of James Buchanan and Gordon Tullock, and I knew both of them pretty well, especially Gordon. Gordon was, both became colleagues of mine at George Mason later, after they moved the Center for Study of Public Choice from VPI to George Mason in the 80s. And so I studied under Buchanan, mostly in the area of public finance, back in those days when I was writing a dissertation, relied on his work.
How would you explain the idea of public choice to a layman?
It's just economics is said to be, especially by mainstream economists, the study of incentives. The Austrians wouldn't call it that. Of course, that's a little too narrow. But there's a lot of truth in that. It's in study of human action and human behavior, not just in the business world, but everywhere. And public choice economics applies that thinking, the economic way of thinking, to the study of political decision-making and looks at how the behavior of politicians, bureaucrats, special interest groups, lobbyists, all the participants in politics to understand how government works. And their methodology is methodological individualism, just like the Austrian school. There's no such thing as society making a decision. Individuals make decisions. And so that's one thing they had in common. In fact, when my old professor, James Buchanan, won the Nobel Prize in 1986, the editor of the Review of Austrian Economics, Chuck Baird at the time, asked me to write the article about Buchanan and his connection to Austrian economics, because he was a fellow traveler. He wrote some very well-known books on subjective cost theory. One of them is called Cost and Choice. And that's why, by the way, Richard Wagner, who I mentioned earlier, who was a student of Buchanan's at the University of Virginia, when he taught my first semester of microeconomics in graduate school, he used Human Action by Ludwig von Mises as one of the textbooks, along with Milton Friedman's textbook that is used at the University of Chicago at the time.
So when you say that according to public choice, it can be useful to think of government officials and bureaucrats in a particular way, to think of them in a way as being like, maybe I'm misstating this, Tom, but like market actors in their own way, except instead of seeking profit in the form of dollars, they're seeking it in the form of votes?
Yeah, they act in their own self-interest, just like everybody else. And you can't go too far astray if you operate by that assumption and not the assumption that they're angels. They're only pursuing the public interest. And yeah, in government, no profit and loss statements. They're only budgets. And government bureaucrats, for example, are assumed to be budget maximizers. Every bureaucrat is an empire builder and a budget maximizer. And another way of looking at that is that they're cost maximizers. That's why there have been hundreds of studies comparing private and government provision of the same type of service, garbage collection, schools, you name it. And surprise, government always is, many, many times more expensive. And public choice provides a pretty straightforward explanation, and that your typical government bureaucrat, to progress in his or her career, wants to have a bigger budget, a bigger staff, more perquisites, and so forth. And that's how they progress in their career and get a bigger and better job. And they tend to be cost maximizers, whereas an entrepreneur in the private sector is the opposite, is a cost minimizer, because that's how you maximize profit. Cost minimization is the flip side of profit maximization in any business, but it's just the opposite in government. Government tries to maximize cost because they're playing with somebody else's money.
There's something called the Washington Monument Syndrome that when I learned about it, it taught me a lot about how government works, and it taught me about the need to be skeptical of various claims, particularly claims that the budget is just at rock bottom. We can't get by on this budget. The most urgent things now have to be cut. So if you could explain the Washington Monument Syndrome, I'd be grateful.
Yeah, the history of that was that in the 1960s, I believe it was 1965, the head of the National Park Service, who administers all the monuments, including the Washington Monument in D.C., wanted a bigger budget, and Congress didn't want to give him quite as big a budget as he wanted. And so he shut down the Washington Monument, the most popular tourist destination in Washington, D.C. So there were families on, families taking their vacation, summer vacation from every state who complained to their Congress people about this. You know, we came all the way to Washington, D.C. Seeing the Washington Monument was a number one on our list, things to do with the kids. And they closed it down. What's wrong with you? And so Congress was taught a lesson. They forgot all about the budget cut or the budget reduction and gave the National Park Service the budget they wanted. And so that tactic has been known forever, seemingly, as the Washington Monument Syndrome. I lived in Buffalo, New York for 1 year. I taught at State University of New York at Buffalo right out of graduate school. And in the middle of the winter, they had several referenda on increasing the taxes for the public schools, and they had failed several times. The voters rejected it, voted no. And so in the middle of the winter, they said, okay, no more school buses. We can't afford school buses. And so in Buffalo, New York, it snows all day long every day. and there are no sidewalks. They just plow the snow, no sidewalks. So they basically were saying, we're gonna make your kids walk to school on the streets at 7 o'clock in the morning, unless you give us what we want. And sure enough, they took another vote, and the vote passed. They'll quit garbage collection. They'll lay off police, ambulance services, all these things. You know, I'll never admit that there's any room in the budget to be cut in any non-essential areas. They always go after the most painful things to the taxpayers, and that's the Washington Monument Syndrome.
I came across an example of this when I was writing one of my books like 10-ish years ago, and it involved the military, you'll be surprised to learn. And apparently, the U.S. military had some kind of system in place, or was preparing such a system, that would give them the earliest possible alert in case of a Soviet invasion of Western Europe. They would know about it instantly. At the same time, they also were spending $500 million a year on military marching bands. $500 million a year on military marching bands. So then they're all upset the budget isn't high enough. So which of these things you think they were slated to cut? The thing that's going to alert them about a Soviet invasion, or the military marching bands? The military marching bands were totally safe. Safest job in the military. They're never going to get rid of you, even though you are obviously the least necessary thing.
Yeah. I used to own a condo near Rehoboth Beach, Delaware. It wasn't quite as fancy as Joe Biden's big beach house paid for by some Ukrainian oligarch, apparently. But I'll never forget, on the boardwalk, Bethany Beach, one evening, go over there, and the U.S. Air Force jazz band is performing, and everybody's, you know, having a good time. And I kind of very loudly said, why in the world does the Air Force have a jazz band? And I got all the dirty looks in the world, because, of course, this is the Washington establishment. You know, that's where they go on vacation from D.C., Rehoboth Beach, in the summer. But yeah, that's one of the bigger boondoggles. Plenty of golf courses on military bases, too, I understand.
Yeah, see, an Austrian like you and me, it's like the stink bomb at the party. Nobody wants you asking that question, Tom. I'm enjoying myself here at the taxpayers'
expense.
Yeah, I
call myself the skunk of the picnic.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Well, and of course, the picnic is paid for by tax dollars, so I take pride in being the skunk. Now, of course, over the course of your career, you've written books for the general public, quite a few of them, but yet you've also done scholarly work in the academic journals, and both of those are important. But as you look back on your writing career, is there a particular thing you did, maybe one or two, that stand out that you're especially proud of, that I did this, and you know, if it hadn't been for me, nobody else would have done it?
Well, yeah, there are a few things I would look at there, but of course, the biggest impact would be my book, The Real Lincoln, that Lou Rockwell said, wrote a great article about me called The Great Tom DiLorenzo on LouRockwell.com. And he pointed this out. He says, I demolished the Lincoln myth. And one of the reasons I got into that is I was convinced that the Lincoln myth is the ideological cornerstone of American statism and has been for generations. And so it needed to be looked at a little more closely. And so that's probably the thing I'm most known for, oddly enough. After spending several decades as an academic economist, I just got interested in, but it's much more of a libertarian topic than a strictly economic topic, writing on Lincoln. And I'm also proud of, among my academic articles, of demolishing the antitrust myth, the idea that capitalism in the late 19th century was running amok and creating monopolies everywhere, and government, like Roy Rogers on his white horse, came riding in to the rescue and save the consumers from these rapacious monopolists. And that turns out to be the opposite of the truth. What was going on is there are a lot of mergers, and the prices were dropping precipitously as a result of the mergers and economies of scale. And it was the sour grapes competitors who wanted antitrust laws. They wanted to stop the progress of economies of scale and lower costs, lower prices, more products. They didn't like that. And so, and I published an article called The Origins of Antitrust in the International Review of Law and Economics, and a few other places also. And so I'm proud of having done that, because I think in one of my articles, the last line, very last line, was that Senator John Sherman, who's the Sherman Antitrust Act is named after, arguably did more damage to the U.S. economy than did his elder brother, General William Tecumseh Sherman, the famous Civil War general. And that's sort of a smart aleck remark at the end of one of my articles. It's probably true.
I read that article, so I'll just tell you, that's one of the things I did in preparing for Mises University. I read that. And so what you did was, in part in that article, was to consider the characteristics that neoclassical economics identifies as being associated with monopoly. So rising prices and lower quantities of goods. And you see that, then you know you've got monopoly on your hands. So you went through, and you know, data from the 19th century is not as abundant as we might like, but you went through what we had. And as I recall, it was something like 17 industries, and you found that all but two of them wound up with prices going down, that in general, I think the exceptions were castor oil and matches.
Yeah.
Okay, we could probably get by all right in the face of that, and that output was increasing. And so the astonishing thing here is that you got all these, you know, history professors who don't know anything. They don't know what a monopoly is, whatever. They don't know anything. They know none of the economic concepts involved. But they didn't even bother at least to look. You know, there's the data sitting right there. All you have to do is look at it. Does the reality of what was happening conform to the story you're telling? And they didn't bother because they just liked telling that story.
Yeah, they sure did. When I was doing that research, I had my research assistant. I was at George Mason at the time, my graduate research assistant. I told him, go to the library and bring back every book on antitrust law that you can find, or antitrust in general. So I had a huge stack of books in my office of every book you could find on antitrust. And I looked through every single one of them to read what they had to say about this period, the late 1880s. 1890 was the Sherman Antitrust Act. And not one of them had a single statistic on what was going on with output, production, prices. Every single one of them used very colorful language. Even the University of Chicago law and economics people like Richard Posner, he had a very widely used popular textbook on antitrust economics at the time, and Robert Bork as well. Nothing on the, not even the Chicago School economists bothered, you know, with their reputation about empiricism and econometrics and all that. Well, one statistic. And so step two for my research assistant was to gather the GDP statistics and the price statistics that were available at that period of history. And we found that there were dramatic, I mean, a lot of cases, dramatic explosions in production in some of these industries by 175%, something like in some of them. And then 10 years of price declines. And 10 years after the Sherman Act, 10 years before and 10 years after, most of these industries, and the industries that you mentioned are the ones that I had him go through the congressional record and write down all the industries that were being complained about by saying they're accused of being monopolies.
Yes, that's right.
So I got the list of what industries to look at, and that those are the ones who are being accused of being monopolies, and the exact opposite was true.
And now, a word from our sponsor.
I'll bet you've read or watched plenty of murder mysteries before. Well, I'm inviting you to participate in one with me. I'm bringing my murder mystery dinner parties around the United States, and I'd like you to join me. Here's how it works. You get assigned a character. You are given background information about your character weeks before you arrive. And throughout the evening, you'll receive printed briefings about things you should say to various other characters and other information that will guide the story along. We'll enjoy a catered dinner in a large luxury hotel room, and shortly after the meal, one character will be dead. It's then up to each one of us to figure out who done it. At woodsmystery.com, you'll see a list of the cities where I'll be, and if you don't see a party in your area, sign up to be notified when we add more of them. I hope to see you there, so together we can find the killer.
We have a friend in our tradition, Dominic or Dom Armentano, who has a book called Antitrust and Monopoly, Anatomy of a Policy Failure. And I've heard him speak before I read his book. And when he spoke, he more or less said this: I went through and looked at all the antitrust cases and I read the arguments. And what I was looking for was one example in which the strategy of so-called predatory pricing had been successful. And I couldn't find a single one. So predatory pricing, I know it sounds plausible, people. I know you think you've seen it, where a business will price its products well below cost for an extended period of time to drive all its competitors out. And then once they're out, they raise the prices and they reap monopoly gains. I know you think you've seen this. What you've seen is two-thirds of it, perhaps. You may have seen a little bit of it. But you never get to that stage where they get to reap the monopoly benefits. That's the problem. There are many, many strategic problems with the predatory pricing model. And Armentano went through, and he did work nobody would want to do, reading all these court cases. He said, I couldn't find a single one.
Yeah. That book was published in the 1980s, first edition, and he picked out the 55 most famous federal antitrust cases. You know, on that topic and a lot of other topics, it just didn't fit the narrative. And your audience, Tom, by the way, might, if they're interested in this whole topic, an old essay that I published, the Cato Institute published it for me. It was called The Myth of Predatory Pricing. If you just Google The Myth of Predatory Pricing, it's on Cato's website still to this day. I did a survey of that on my own. And even at that time, in the 80s, there was an antitrust publication. I think it was called the Antitrust Bulletin. And they ran an article that claimed to examine every single federal predatory pricing case ever up to that point, like 100 years. And they failed to demonstrate that there was a single instance of a monopoly being created. They had some industries where there may have been 7 or 10 competitors, where there used to be 50. But there are a lot of reasons for that. It's always true that there's always a relatively few who are better than all the rest. Just like in the National Football League, there's always 3 or 4 or 5 teams that are better than the rest. It's the same thing in business, in any industry at any one point in time. And so, yeah, that's one of the bigger myths. And if you understand Austrian economics and are skeptical about government claims with a little bit of libertarianism mixed in, you would ask different questions in studying something like this than your typical mainstream economist, I think.
I'll link to that article, by the way, in the description of the video and also at tomwoods.com/2418. What was your first exposure to what we call the Austrian School of Economics as a young man?
Well, as a young man, well, my first exposure, I didn't even know it was Austrian economics. It was a pure accident. My very first semester in college, freshman in college, I signed up for Principles of Economics, and I go into the classroom, and there was a bookshelf. And in the bookshelf was all the back issues of the Freeman magazine by the Foundation for Economic Education. And so I started reading these, and these articles are great. They're articles by Ludwig von Mises, Friedrich Hayek, Henry Aslett, Gary North, I remember, Israel Kirzner. And if I'm studying economics, this stuff was much more interesting than the textbook that I was studying at the time. And that was probably my first introduction. There was no Mises Institute. There was nobody to guide me along. I just sort of by accident read across this. And then when I went to graduate school, like I said, my first semester, we used Human Action as a textbook. And that was my real introduction to Austrian economics. And this was a graduate program where it was sort of a sink or swim. I think we started out with 30 or 35 students and 9 finished their PhDs. And so you're given Human Action to read. You better read it and you better understand what it says or else you're going to flunk out. And, you know, 1 D or 1 bad grade, 2 C's, I think, would have flunked you out of the program in the way it was in those days. And there was a big, long reading list, of course. And Professor Wagner, if I mentioned Richard Wagner, I couldn't wait to get to his class. It was so interesting. And so it was so very different from all the other, you know, highly technical, mathematized classes and pretty much exercises in advanced mathematics, which was, you know, fun and games. But Wagner's class with Human Action was the real economics class in my first year in graduate school.
Would you say the Austrian world is divided? And if so, what do the fault lines look like?
Well, I don't think it's a bad thing that if there's a divided, there's always been some division. Early in my career, I published an article in the Cato Journal very early in my career, and I cited Murray Rothbard's book, America's Great Depression, in passing. It wasn't the main point of the article at all, but I'd mentioned something about the Great Depression. I footnoted Murray Rothbard's book, and the editor of the Cato Journal at the time called me on the phone and asked me to delete that reference because Murray Rothbard and anything associated with Murray Rothbard was supposed to be persona non grata, I guess. I argued with him for a half hour and I refused to delete it. And so he let me have my way and kept it in. And then, so there was always been a conscious effort on the part of sort of the Washington, D.C. libertarian crowd, which is also associated with George Mason very closely, by the way, to put Mises and Rothbard out of the way. They're a little too radical. Hayek has always been seen as being more acceptable, especially if you look at his earlier writings where he's basically a social democrat. And that's, after all, the business plan of the Washington think tanks with a libertarian bent has always been to try to influence the Washington establishment. It's turned out that the opposite has happened, that the Washington establishment has influenced them, but that's always been their business plan. So I think that is one of the causes of sort of differences in the Austrian school. And it was one of the reasons why I have been working with the Mises Institute for so many years. The breaking point, I was one of the original adjunct scholars at Cato when they first moved to D.C. And Richard Fink was the head of the Koch Foundation for a time. He was a colleague of mine at George Mason for a few years. His office was literally next to mine. So I knew Richie very well. And he got me in as an adjunct scholar at Cato. But a few years later, they asked me to write a chapter on their annual guide for Congress. They had this annual book, you know, Congress Should Do This. They asked me to write the chapter on antitrust. So I wrote it, and it came back for my review before publishing, and it was totally different. I didn't recognize it. It sounded like it had been written by a congressional staffer, which it probably was. And so that was the beginning of the end. And so I thought, well, I can't do this. And I started sending articles to the free market. Jeff Tucker was editing the Free Market newsletter. This is before the internet. And that was it for me. After attending a couple of Mises Institute conferences and writing for the Free Market, both I, myself, and Ralph Rako, who had been also participating in the Mises Institute in the early days, got a letter from Jim Doran, one of the vice presidents of Cato, saying, "We no longer need your services as an adjunct scholar," because I'd been associating with Rothbard and the Mises Institute.
Yeah, it's a nutty situation, you know, and I try to be charitable, you know, I try to be charitable to people. I have some of those people on every once in a while because they, you know, there are a handful of good, solid folks there. But there was a policy, which is no longer in effect for some time. You think I'm making this up? I am not making this up. If you are associated with Cato, you cannot, not only can you not come on the Tom Woods Show, you can't even like one of my tweets, not retweet it. You can't even like it. You know, you can like it in your heart, maybe, but you can't like it on the system. And I have heard this from multiple people because I have friends in a lot of places. And I just thought, isn't this fun? I mean, of all possible things to be concerned, you know, this is crazy. But also, Rothbard's book, America's Great Depression, is a great book. It's the best thing we have on the Great Depression. So it's highly revealing that they would take that approach. And then when it comes to Hayek, I know that, you know, our friend Joe Salerno, who's academic vice president of the Mises Institute, is quite fond of Hayek's work, his business cycle work and his capital work in the 30s and early 40s. But that's never what anybody wants to focus on. It's always the political stuff or the philosophical stuff, which is not all bad, but what he won the Nobel Prize for is the stuff in the 30s. And nobody really wants to talk about that, even though that's the really great hardcore Hayek. On the other hand, Walter Block tells a story that he was at a Liberty Fund colloquium with Milton Friedman, and that Walter was defending the Austrian theory of the business cycle. And that at one point, Friedman went over to him and said, "Look, Walter, be honest here. You've read Prices and Production. Can you make head or tail of what in the world he's even saying in there?" So if even Friedman can't understand some of these Hayekian writings, maybe I'm expecting too much of people.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, I might have been at that same conference because what it probably was you know, they have these indexes of economic freedom. The Heritage Foundation publishes one, the Fraser Institute. They rank all the countries of the world according to freedom. But Walter Block was actually one of the founders of that whole project. And there's a series of Liberty Fund conferences. And I wrote the initial chapter on labor markets for that. And I remember sitting next to Milton and Rose Friedman in Banff, Canada. And that was probably the same conference. Walter was there. And I still have a picture. We took a side trip to the top of one of the Rocky Mountains in Banff. And I have a picture of me, Walter Block, and Milton Friedman with the Rockies in the background. And that's probably where that was. But, you know, Hayek, you know, that was his what he won the Nobel Prize for. And in the 70s, you know, stagflation and all that. Yeah, that was really earth-shattering because, that was sort of a mea culpa on the part of the economics profession that we screwed up. We can't explain stagflation in the 70s. And here's this guy who had a better idea all these years ago.
How would you situate the Mises Institute among other, even though the Mises Institute is Austrian economics, obviously there's libertarianism all over it as well. How would you situate it among libertarian institutions? And I'm not asking you to say it's the most awesome one, even though in my opinion it is, because there are other good institutions that just have a different emphasis. So what's the Mises Institute's unique role?
Well, I think the Mises Institute is more scholarly than a lot of the others. A lot of the others are too focused, in my opinion, on commenting on the latest bill before Congress, that sort of thing. Not that there's anything inherently wrong about that. That's what makes the Institute different. You know, Mises University, which you went through as an undergraduate and you taught it many years, you know, it's very rigorous training for college students. As far as that goes, you know, how many students have I had or you had when you were teaching there? You said, I learned more this week than I had in the last 4 years in the economics program at University XYZ, wherever I came from. And then, of course, the publications, like, you know, the Mises bookstore is wonderful with all the books, and especially yours and mine, at the Mises bookstore and the whole library. And the thing that is also most unique is I call it the Rothbardian Misesian tradition. Well, I consider the two greatest Austrians of the last two generations, Rothbard and Ludwig von Mises. We do everything we can to stick to the tradition of scholarship by these two great scholars, and not everyone's willing to do that, and especially the Rothbardian part, because that's where the libertarianism comes in for the most part, you know, much more than just strict economics of human action and Mises' economics writings. And Murray, I'll never forget my first, I keep talking about my first class with Richard Wagner and using human action, but he gave us a quote by von Mises on the first day of class of what it takes to be an economist in the eyes of Ludwig von Mises. And it said something to the effect that, well, economics is only part of it. You need to be schooled in history, philosophy, mathematics, statistics, political philosophy to really understand the economic world around you. And if you read, you know, Mises' writings, you know what he was talking about, and some of the other great Austrians too. And so and it's a long road. I'm sort of a minor pipsqueak compared to these great scholars, but I've always looked at that as the highest of high bars to try to achieve, as being that type of a scholar as much as I can, you know, within my ability. And that's why I think we have so many brilliant young students who got a little bit of information, like yourself, Tom, who learned a little bit about Austrian economics and was headed straight for Auburn, Alabama in the summer to learn more about it.
Well, I will say that I, as a student, found it absolutely thrilling to spend that week in, it wasn't yet Auburn. We were still out in California for the Mises University program, but then to be on the other side of it and actually be up there speaking was a real thrill for me. And I think maybe 4 years running, I was giving the opening talk on the Sunday night when we were kicking things off, and that was always a thrill. And then it's just been one thing after another. It's either just travel or other family obligations, whatever, have gotten in the way. So I'm not going to put you on the spot here, even though I know you are the new president of the Mises Institute. But by 2025, I really would love to do that again if I were ever given that opportunity, because I consider it is such a thrilling week, no matter whether you're the student or the professor. It is Because not only are you talking about things that are so interesting that help you understand the world so much better, but you're surrounded by people who, you know, many of them could have been in more prestigious positions if they would just have said what they were supposed to say, and people who were just, who don't care about any of that. They just want to teach the truth. And you get all these students who know they're doing the most academically unfashionable thing on earth, and yet it's the thing they most want to do. To spend a week with people like that is just, you can't put a price tag on it.
Yeah, that's what's why, you know, for years we, you know, I don't know if you've ever used this language, but a lot of us have called Auburn our Mecca, the Mises Institute, sort of, because it is a pilgrimage. You're going to fly to Atlanta, then an hour and a half drive to get there. We don't call it Gulch Gulch, but we call it our Mecca. I've been doing that for years. And for that very reason, and of course, we would love to have you at any time to come back. You have five children, so I'm sure family obligations are through the roof.
Yeah, but you know what, Tom? But now they're all getting older. You know, one of them's 20, one's 18, one's 17.
Hard to believe. Yeah.
We still have one who's 9, but they enjoy traveling. And, you know, my kids actually always like being at the Mises Institute. I remember during COVID, the Mises Institute still had its Austrian economics. Maybe not that. But they did have Mises U, I think, in 2020.
Yes, they did. Yeah.
It was a smaller... Yeah. Now, the problem with the research conference was that the Europeans, who are a major part of that, couldn't come over. It was just a crazy disaster. But the following year, in 2021, I'm pretty sure there was a mask mandate in effect in Alabama. But the way they had worded it was, all places that are open to the public must have a mask policy in place. And so when I got to the Mises Institute that year, they had plastered all over the doors to the building, not open to the public, so that they would be exempt from the mask mandate.
That's right. Yeah, I remember that. On not open to the public, and there were no masks being worn.
Yeah.
And which is ridiculous that we even have to think about.
We all survived, though, Tom. We all survived it.
Yeah, well, like we said, you know, when you visited us in Florida, what was that? That was like summer of 2020.
Yeah, it was, I think, June of 2020. Yeah.
And DeSantis originally went along with this and shut everything down. And then he must have had a what the hell am I doing moment. And by May, I have to look up. I have a picture of me at my favorite bar hangout in Delray Beach, opening day, when they finally reopened everything. I have to look up the date, but I'm pretty sure it was like late May. So it didn't last very long. And then when you visited in the summer, we sat in an open air bar with live music and a lot of masks to be seen anywhere. But as you know, not every state was like that.
Well, we got a picture. The four of us, we got a picture together that makes me very happy. But I remember at the time being both happy and a little weirded out as I was sitting there thinking, the number of people around the world enjoying live music right now is vanishingly small.
Yes.
But yet I'm among that number.
That's right. Yeah, it was the very opening night, there's an outdoor bar there called Salt in Delray Beach. And they opened like at 5 o'clock or something, or when they made it legal. And I remember walking by there, and it was shoulder to shoulder, inside and outside. And there were all these scowling bureaucrats, you know, standing around, taking pictures. And other people, I don't know who these people were, taking pictures as though there was a crime scene occurring. People were laughing and smiling and having fun and having a cocktail. And he had all these nannies walking around, taking pictures. I don't know who they're going to send the pictures to. That was the scene. But everyone there was sort of thumbing their noses at the people on the sidewalk taking their pictures.
Well, I'll tell one more little story, and then we'll call it a day. My wife and I have gone several years in a row now to St. John, which I know you love, in the Virgin Islands. So we went there and decided that we also loved it. But they were mask crazy. And their rationale was, we barely even have a hospital on St. John. So whatever we need to do to keep mass sickness away, we're going to do it. And they thought masking would... I mean, I'm giving them the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah.
So that meant that even as you're driving around in these open-air vehicles that transport people from the beach to the beach and back, you had to have a mask on. Well, some of us just weren't doing it because we all could see how ridiculous that was. But one day we were in one of these vehicles, and there was a family with some young women, probably like around 20 years old, behind us. and one of them was demanding very loudly that I put my mask on. And I tried to reason with her, and she wouldn't hear. She demanded that I put it on. I said, I'll put it on, but I need you to understand that other than making you feel better, it will accomplish nothing. And she's getting more hostile. And I kept my cool. And I said, are you aware that demographically similar populations situated next to each other with different mask policies have the same health results? I mean, why do you think that is? I think that is at least suggestive evidence. And do you know what her response was? I'm not kidding you, Tom. Her response was, stop. Stop. So I'm using reason, and she wants me to stop.
Yeah.
So I put the mask on, but it was one of these fake mesh masks that I got from a guy I had on my show who made masks you could actually breathe through. Yeah. So it still didn't accomplish anything. Now, by the way, we were dropped off at our place, and those people continued on to theirs. We got there, and I realized, oh my gosh, I left my phone there. I left my phone on this vehicle. We have to call them, those people I just denounced with the mask, and hope they answer the phone so that we can go back and get it. But thankfully, there was one member of the family who was somewhat reasonable, and he answered and said, yeah, your phone's here. I'll give it to the driver. Of all times to lose my phone. Well, anyway, Tom, I hope your tenure as president of the Mises Institute is super successful, that it reaches new heights, and it's a fitting capstone to your long career in the trenches.
Oh, that's my goal, Tom, and I'm looking forward to trying to do some really great things and really rev up the Mises Institute. It's already running on all these cylinders right now. All the programs are doing great right now. And we have the best website in the world on the topic of economics. And so I'm looking forward to it, and I'm looking forward to having you back as a lecturer.
I appreciate that, Tom. Thank you very much. The website, mises.org. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.